Good evening, Erev Tov. So our topic tonight is this very fascinating article. I thought it was fascinating that appeared in the New York Times about the mistaken identity of quote unquote patient zero. They thought they had their man, and it turns out he was not patient zero. He's not responsible for the AIDS epidemic. I can't say that he was a tzaddik. It sounds like this person was definitely not begedra tzaddik, but he's not patient zero. Okay. So when I saw that article, the first thing that came to my mind was, wow, well, what are the halachic implications of this question? You know, what are the things that need to be considered in terms of finding patient zero? Should you or shouldn't you? And if you do, what are the ramifications of identifying that person by name? So, a makir tov to Dr. Reichman, who I sent this article to and shared some ha'aros, a colleague of mine, Rabbi Josh Flug, and then I spent some time on the phone with Rav Schechter, just trying to get their sense of the different pieces of the puzzle here. So, the first step, which I think we all can agree on, is that if there's no benefit to identifying this patient by name, then doing so is a violation of Lashon Hara, right? Lashon Hara is true, but it's saying something that's going to damage someone, and in this case, it would clearly be damaging, and it wouldn't just be in the case of the AIDS epidemic that they're talking about, but there are other similar kinds of circumstances. You know, Dr. Reichman told me, and I didn't know this, that apparently rubella, as of last year, has officially been eradicated from the Americas. But if somebody told you that they knew patient zero who's going to bring back rubella, God forbid, so that person probably wouldn't be popular in their high school reunion. You know, that you wouldn't want to be that person. So there are certainly negative effects that go with it. But the question is, well, what happens if you'd say, no, it will be beneficial to someone to identify who is patient zero? Now, why would that be the case? So you could say one of two things. You could either talk about a benefit like Typhoid Mary, where you have someone who you know is a danger to people, and in that case, she actually was infecting the people in whose house she worked. And then after, I think she was quarantined for a period of time in the Bronx, and then she escaped. She was let out, and then she disappeared, changed her name, and then went back to work.
They let her out under the promise that she would not...
Exactly.
She
went back to work as a cook in somebody's house. So there's that benefit. And then there's the question of the research benefit. Because maybe some epidemiologists or ID doctors will say, look, you know, if we know something more about patient zero, the first patient to get, I don't know, Zika or some other disease, that'll tell us Ebola something about the nature of the disease and what we can learn about it. So in terms of immediate benefits, so I believe last year we discussed the Tshuva of Rav Ovadia about the driver's license case. You know, a physician sees the patient clearly is unfit, may they have some kind of illness, whether it's an eye deficiency or some kind of other ailment that will cause them to have some potential serious problems in their driving. So Rav Ovadia said that to save the benefit of the community, so you're obligated to call the DMV and tell them they can't issue this person a driver's license. So that's one. We discussed that a little bit at length. I found two more in the same vein, questions in terms of how far do you need to go in terms of identifying a potential hazard. So Rav Zilverstein's farm, which we've quoted before, so on page 1 and page 2, is two cases of how far you have to go. These are pretty extreme. Let's leave it at that. The first one, as you'll see, the first case is regarding a moel. This is dated Tafshin Nun Hei, which means we're in Ayin Zayin now, so it's 22 years ago. A moel who is hospitalized in Yerushalayim because he's suffering from syphilis, as you see on the second line. Now, how did this moel get syphilis? So we don't know for sure, but the patient, this moel, apparently has been traveling to various far-flung places to perform a bris milah. And the concern is that when he's been in these unsavory types of places, he's been involved in some unsavory activities, which is where he may have picked up this particular disease. So the shaila, as you see on the third paragraph, hasheilahi, are the doctors mechuyav to publicly announce this, to tell local rabbis? Should they passel the moel? Should they describe the circumstances that may or may not have led to this case? How do you deal with the implications of what that's going to mean in terms of preventing him from being a moel? How far do you have to go? What do you think? So first he starts off talking about, well, wait a second. Everybody has a cheskas kashrus. So just because you suspect such and such, that doesn't mean that you put that on a placard and you advertise it outside. But on the other hand, he says, you need to tell the local rabbis that until this person is healed, because apparently, according to the article, it says that syphilis is curable, then until you take care of it, he shouldn't be allowed to perform any bris milas. Well, what about making future pronouncements to sink his career? So he says, that far you don't go yet. Because you have to make sure, 100% sure, of what's going to happen afterwards before you totally destroy his career. Maybe he'll never go back to any of that activity and he won't have this problem anymore. So that's one case of, you see somebody who has a potential disease who could be affecting other people, so you have to identify it and deal with it. A more extreme case, get ready for the page 2, this is in Chelek. This is in Chelek Hay, in this volume. La'orer mehuma b'chasana kedei lahatzel eschasan. Okay, doctors, has this ever happened to you? You ready? Rofei hanimsa b'chasana. This one is from only 6 years ago. A doctor appears at a wedding, and he sees on the chasan a pricha b'or, something in his skin. And according to what the rofei seems is the case, it's a likely problem that he is one of the following. I don't know what these are. TTP, ITP, leukemia, or the next one, SBE. I don't know what that, what do these stand for?
A lot of bad diseases.
A lot of bad stuff.
Hematologic diseases.
Okay. So,
for the most part,
one can...
He probably has some hemorrhages.
Oh, because of the black and blue, whatever it is.
Oh. Bacterial endocarditis.
Yeah.
So the first question he distinguishes are between contagious and non-contagious diseases. So here you are, you're sitting at the wedding, and you see the chassan is walking down the aisle. So he wants to know: Do you need to jump out and tackle the guy and haul him off to the hospital? So he says, wait a second, okay, let's think about this. First of all, how sure are you? How sure are you? Maybe he just played tackle football yesterday and has a welt or something like that, I don't know. Well, what's going to happen if you do this? Aside from the fact that the mechutanim probably will not invite you to their next simcha, what are people going to say? What are they going to say about going to you when somebody's going to look for a referral? You may lose your job. So these are complicating factors. Then let's say, okay, you don't think that it's just a concern for the chassan. Maybe you think it's a communicable disease. Maybe it could affect the kala. Maybe it could affect other people at the wedding. So first he quotes his father-in-law, the late Rav Yashiv Zeher Tzadik Livracha, who says that, look, if you're not 100% sure, let's say you're 90% sure, then you don't have to risk losing your job, your livelihood, if you're only 90% sure, if there's a 10% chance that you're going to make a mistake. And if it's just a concern for the chassan, so you go over, you can speak to him privately, and if he says no, you can't handcuff him and take him to the emergency room. But he does conclude that if you are absolutely certain that this could be a danger to other people, you are mechuyev to do whatever it takes to make sure that this doesn't affect anybody else, which could mean the kala. You may have to step into the yichud room. You have to get by those guys and tell them, you know, I'm an expert physician. I can tell you with 97.5% accuracy that what you have needs to be checked out by a doctor because it's potentially contagious. She should not, you got to do it.
How far does that extend? Is it only if we're talking about a disease? What if it's a behavior?
So it's a great question. We'll come back to that in a little bit. I'm going to circle back to that in a little bit. That, I think, is a further, we'll come back to it in a minute, but this is, if you know there's an immediate danger, you know that there's somebody who is, you know, who's patient zero. That's if you know he's patient zero and he's going to affect other people. What if he's not going to affect anybody else because it's already out there? You know, let's say if you came across today the patient zero from Zika, would that save a lot of lives? Probably not. Because
Zika doesn't affect adults in a serious way. It's just an unborn child.
So you would tell them...
No, Ebola, that's a different story.
Right. But finding that person would be important, potentially, for research, but not necessarily because...
A few hours.
It's not going to necessarily impact other people standing around that person. Well, then, well, what's the status of that? Do you say, well, you have a chiyuv to do research, and therefore you're going to undertake, you know, some kind of action that's maybe questionable? You know, where does Lashon Hara fit into this? Okay, so you're concerned about Lashon Hara, but you also have the research aspect. So I asked Rav Schechter, I asked Dr. Reichman, I asked Rav Schechter, what is the nature of medical research in halacha? Is it a chiyuv to do medical research? Is it a mitzvah to do medical research? How would you categorize that? You know, I'll give you an example, a rough example. You know, you have a mitzvah to shake the lulav, right? Buy dalav minim. To buy dalav minim is not a mitzvah. It's a hechsher mitzvah. It happens to be that you can't do the dalav minim without having dalav minim, but the purchasing of the dalav minim, that's a hechsher mitzvah. Tying the tzitzis is a hechsher mitzvah. Building the sukkah is a hechsher mitzvah. That's a preparatory.
That's a lot in Pashol.
Exactly. So that's the question. What is the end of the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, of hatzalas nefashos? How far does it extend? So Schechter said what I thought was a fascinating suggestion. He said, well, all the cases that I gave you are all you have one defined action that constitutes the mitzvah. You have what we can call a maisim mesuyam, a specific action. Shaking a lulav, sitting in the sukkah, wearing the tzitzis, those are defined actions. Pikuach nefesh, it doesn't have a defined action. The person, God forbid, is drowning in the water, and you're the lifeguard, and you have a life preserver. So, grabbing the life preserver, throwing it into the person, dragging him out, that's all the action of, that's all the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. So Rav Schechter suggested that therefore, there is no distinction between a mitzvah and the preparation of a mitzvah. It's all the mitzvah pikuach nefesh. Memela, halachic glasses would look at medical research and say, that's also pikuach nefesh. You know, working for the NIH, that's pikuach nefesh, because maybe through your research and development, you may come up with a cure to save somebody. And this is the huge nafkamina, at least the way I'm going to understand it. Number one, in terms of the Lashon Hara factor, you know, but I think there's another issue. Dr. Eichmann pointed out to me that in many cases, medical research, which is being done today, would be considered from a halachic perspective very questionable, because people submit themselves to clinical trials of various kinds, which according to the halacha is a big question. Are you permitted to subject yourself to a clinical trial? What are the risks involved? How much danger can you put yourself in? What's the benefit? So here's where I think the huge nafkamina is. If you say that medical research, it's a nice thing, it's good for society, good Samaritan, but it's not really a mitzvah, so you would say there's not a very compelling argument to put any particular person or a community at risk, even a low threshold of risk, to do research for something. Because you'd say, you want to do you want to be a pious person, because today you can be pious and do medical research, but don't do it at the risk of someone's health, even a small risk. But if you say that medical research really constitutes pikuach nefesh, it's actually a life-saving activity, then you would have a much higher threshold by which to judge how much risk you would be willing to undertake, because it's not just stam a nice thing to do. It's a real mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. So then you would say, well, if it's real pikuach nefesh, then I really have to take it more seriously. So now you're going to take that even further. Does that mean that somebody who works in the NIH should drive to the office every Shabbos morning? Because he's pikuach nefesh, saving lives. He has his petri dishes waiting for him. He has his computer, his instruments. So that's not the case.
Indirect versus direct.
Okay. Great. So there's a very important note of view here. If you look on the next page. Yeah. Yeah.
Does he give any examples at all where there would be sufficient certainty based on, you know, something similar to it, seeing a person at a wedding? you could be absolutely certain that you know what's going on based on that, you know, relatively simple observation. Because I'm looking at these examples that he gives as a possible diagnosis. There's not a single one here that I would confident based on physical examination alone.
Well, if you were the physician, if you knew, this is your patient who you found out is getting wedded, married, and you know he has a community, you know he's got HIV, he's got.
You don't have to wait till the wedding. Is
no, but I'm saying, so rather than, but it's the same situation, like you and Diphtheria, are you obligated to go on Diphtheria in that case? There, you're 100% certain you did the blood work, you have the results.
So that's a different story. I mean, this, there's probably an answer to that. This case, I'm just kind of perplexed because.
What are the examples here?
He says TTP,
yeah.
ITP,
yeah.
SBE,
yeah.
Leukemia.
Leukemia.
Yeah. See, none of those are really communicable diseases. So there's
well, not only
really,
that,
you
know, not only that. I mean, just on the basis of the physical exam, you might say, well, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this, or, like Rabbi Brand said, it could be this person just got beat up, you know, played football. You know, that's part of the differential diagnosis, right, of hemorrhages in the fingers, right, underneath the fingernails.
I was thinking...
Probably the most common cause of...
I think it's just the questions are looking at the different gradations of certainty. So how certain are you? In the first case, you're the doctor who knows the mohel has syphilis. Here, you're a doctor who suspects something. There, you know, so at what point do you, are you able to, at what level of certainty are you obligated or able to interfere? And then the other question is, at what level of endanger, like, does it have to be communicable, or does it have to be, well, does this woman know she's getting married to a potentially guy who's going to make her a widow? You know, does she know that she's married to a guy who has this horrible disease that she has to live with? Or is this a disease that doesn't affect anyone other than the person? I think it's all a matter of gradations, and that's what... The halakha is going to depend on that.
Well, those cases are complicated. I'm glad I would have Rabbi Brand to talk to.
I would certainly be calling a posek.
I mean, this case, I just can't imagine a scenario where I'd be a guest at a wedding and, you know, feel sufficiently confident of almost anything. I mean, unless the person is... blue.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's what the suffix is in those.
Okay.
In
that you could go, oh, am I the only person here that recognizes this person's blue?
Yeah.
that would be, I'd be 100% certain that would be bad.
Right. So I'm saying I think that's the whole suffix in that specific shaila. Here you have two doubts. One is the doubt is A, of your diagnosis, and B, even if your diagnosis is correct, is anyone else in danger? So do you have any standing to interfere in this case?
Right. So
in the first case, you have more of a standing, and I think that's what it's looking at. At what point you say yes, and what point you say no?
Okay, that's helpful.
I think it's pretty far-fetched. At least it seemed to me as a reader of this tshuva that it was far-fetched. But sometimes what we find in general, let's say when you learn Gemara, you learn through different sugyas, and you find the Gemara asks the most far-out, ridiculous questions. And why do they do that? Why did the Chazal formulate that? Because what they want to do is, they want to give you the upper limits and the boundaries, the parameters of the halacha, and then from there you can figure out what the middle cases are. So some of these cases are just wacky shilas that it gets, but some of them are helpful, even though they are extreme and theoretical, and probably something like this, like you said, you know, unless you have X-ray vision, how would you know what exactly this person has? But it's a good test case to talk about the variables that would go into that kind of thing, which is exactly what he uses it to do. And then it's always, you know, like you said, then there comes into the halachic risk-benefit issue. You know, if you're sitting in an office with somebody, so then to say to them, well, you may have A, B, or C, that's different than sitting at a wedding, because the risk of, you know, mavayish es chavero and gorim hefsid for the wedding and all kinds of other problems is different than you're sitting in a, you know, in an office. They can tell you 100 things that maybe you have, maybe you don't have. So it's always the cost benefit. There's the lashon hara factor. You know, the lashon hara factor is going to be magnified p, you know, many, many times. The question about the informing, we spoke a little bit about that, I think, one of the topics in years last year, maybe. So there also you have competing factors. You have the lashon hara factor and the confidentiality question, and then you have the lo samad al dam reyecha factor, that, you know, what's one person's confidentiality is somebody else's pikuach nefesh, who is unwittingly walking into a situation that could be, you know, in serious danger. So each time you have to calibrate it based, I think, on the risks and the benefits. So those are the those are the questions. So now you have the parameters question that we're going to get to. Okay, so I think we all can agree that driving to the NIH to work on Shabbos is not pikuach nefesh. Well, where does that end if it's really a mitzvah? So the Rabbi Yehuda in this tshuva, Rabbi Yehuda has a very important klal. It's not universally accepted, but it is very, very important. The Rabbi Yehuda was asked in a tshuva, you see from the top, right, put the little number 3 in. This is in Madur Tinyana in Yoredeya in Simon Reish Yud. Rabbi Yehuda of Yecheskel Landau says, I got a kuntris from London where something happened. A guy who was ill with a choli on the third line here, where the line gets a little bit wider, Ha'even Shebekiso. He had a stone in his kis. So I don't know if that's a gallbladder or a kidney stone, something like that. And the man died. And the physician said, we want to do... autopsy. That's right. We want to do an autopsy. So this autopsy is not going to save any of the immediate relatives. This is it's seemingly just for research purposes. So they sent to the Nodi Behuda, is it permitted to do an autopsy on this niftar to find out something more about this disease? So wait a second. Well, to do an autopsy, you're running into questions about hanam and ames benefiting from a corpse which is prohibited. That's a sham. There's a prohibition. You're not allowed to derive any benefit from a mace. And then there's nivol hames, desecrating a deceased. On the other hand, well, pikuach nefesh, that beats everything except for the big three, and, you know, maybe one or two others. So what do you say? So none of you who says, let me give you a rule. Here's the rule of thumb, bottom where the arrow is. He says, he quotes a series of Gemaras, Benidon didan, right where the arrow is. Ein kan shum chola hatzarech lezeh. Right now, in front of us, there is no ill person who needs this. They want to learn about this illness. Maybe somebody else will come along with the same illness. Because if you call this a safik pikuach nefesh, so then he said, all the malachos, everything would be on Shabbos, would be mutter. Maybe somebody will come along. Right? Maybe you should say, let's say you're a physician. You should say, you know what? I should be able to drive to my office on Shabbos and sit there. Maybe a sick person will arrive. I should be allowed to make a fire in my living room. Maybe somebody will come. I'll need to heat up some instruments for them. I don't know, you know, like sterilize them or whatever. So the Buddha says that's not the case. The limitation of Chola Lefaneinu tells you that if there's no patient that needs your services right now, So then you don't have the right to violate Isurim for that person.
So go by extension to now, if you have an emergency, and you don't have patients at the moment, are you supposed to close it? And only, let's say you're in Israel, so everyone's Jewish, are you supposed to wait until the ambulance says they're on the
great, way? Great, perfect, perfect segue. So the Chazon Ish picks up on that question, right? So the question was, well, what does that mean practically? So do you actually have to have the patient in front of you? So the Chazon Ish on the next page, right, writing from Bnei Brak, the Chazon Ish, great going, is ridiculous. This is in his commentary on Olos. I mean, it's impossible to imagine the greatness of the Chazon Ish. So he writes, he quotes this Pesachei Tshuva, which quotes the Nor Rabbi Yehuda, and he says, look on the third line, Ve'ein achiluk, after my little arrow, Ve'ein achiluk bein isa kaman l'leisa kaman. It's not about whether you have the patient in front of you sitting there right now. Ela im matsui ha'davar. Is it common? So, here's a great example. You have they take your emergency room. For 10 minutes, you have no patients in the emergency room. So you know what you'll say? Nobody should be here. We can't have doctors on staff because no one's here. You can't have the lights running. You can't do A, B, and C because nobody's here. But it's matsui hadavar. People come to the emergency room all the time. And Rav Shachter said the same thing when we go back to our case. You have this patient. His patient zero. You want to do some research. Well, wait a second. If there's an outbreak, so of course that's chol lefaneinu. Maybe you in your hospital today don't have that person in front of you, but it's out there. It's matsui hadavar. Right, there's a whole discussion. Now it's in one neighborhood in Miami. They're worried about the next neighborhood in Miami. Then what about the next one? The mosquitoes don't travel. They know the zip codes. They don't know the zip codes. I don't know. I never interviewed the mosquitoes. But Lahura, that's exactly what the Chazon Ish is saying. Yes, the Nor Rabbi Yehuda, when he says, Chol lefaneinu, in that case, he meant, do you have another patient to deal with? But what the Chazon Ish is saying, what he really meant practically is this theoretical research or is it for some active circumstance? That's the difference. If it's matsui, if it's common. So if you're just doing theoretical research, you know, God willing, everybody, they'll figure out how to cure cancer. But right now, they're so far off from curing cancer, so then the research is theoretical. It's not matsui, I don't think, that somebody can walk in and say, we're on the cusp of a breakthrough that's going to have an immediate impact. You know, it's in a much farther trajectory, so we should invest in that. It's a mitzvah, pikuach nefesh, but that's not going to be docha Shabbos. As opposed to, you have an epidemic, you have an outbreak of some kind, so then you're right, you in your hospital may not have that patient right now, but it's matsui, it's all over the place. And therefore, that would be, according to the Chazon Ish, within the parameters of the Nor Rabbi Yehuda's definition of chol lefaneinu. And that could have a lot of implication, certainly for our case, in terms of you know, naming the person, chasing him down, stuff like that.
What about?
Let's go to the last page. Yeah.
Something like, for example, that I deal with often is, okay, if you're not so much an autopsy request for research, and not because you have an academic, but you have a death of a kid and you don't, a child, and you don't know why. The parents want answers for their own peace of mind, but also sometimes to give them guidance on if they can have more children, what's the risks to the future children. So you don't have an actual patient there in front of you or coming, but it's only for potential patients. Like, where does that fall?
It's a great question. I think it might fall based on exactly the parameters you mentioned. So for example, there might be a difference between saying, well, we need to know if this is something that could affect other immediate, like, family members, when then you would say, yeah, that's a chol lefaneinu, because if it's something that could help save one of the siblings, Rachman Litzlan, somebody, I don't know exactly what that would look like. The doctors obviously know what that means. So then that's one kind of thing. Then you're talking about, you know, a hypothetical. That's a different thing. Then you're talking about a couple that says, well, we want to have more children. So then you have a much more complicated shikul, because you have an important pru-revu question. But that pru-revu question is not the same thing as a pikuach nefesh question. So then it becomes, well, what kind of invasive, you know, what are you doing here? Is this really hanam and ames? Is it nivel ames? You know, what's the mitzvah and what's the iser? And that's going to be a very complex halachic cheshbon. It sounds like a very heartbreaking type of a question. Very heartbreaking.
Okay.
What about a stillborn? Would that be the same category?
I don't want to say with certainty because I don't know off the top of my head. My assumption is the answer is yes, because it's a mace, but it's a human being that's mace. So I assume you have the same restrictions, but I'm not sure, and I'm sure it's written somewhere explicitly. I just haven't come across it or don't remember it.
The reason I ask is because I think if it's a neonate who's been alive for a while, with all the scans available and all the blood tests and everything, I doubt that there's so much more that you're going to get from an autopsy than, you know, doing genetic testing and doing MRIs and...
I don't know. You would know better based on what...
It comes down to the situation. Right. We had one very particular where we couldn't get the information we need and things were too sudden to do all of that. And the question came up with the parents. Parents elected not to in the end. It came up, you know, whether to do at least a partial autopsy because we couldn't and we had no explanation for what happened. And they wanted guidance so that they know what risk their future kids were.
Right.
And we had others where we did the same cheshbon, and they said yes, and we got no information out of it that helped. So it's like
the thing is if that baby came in from home,
yeah,
and died shortly thereafter, there's no information. Yeah, it's out of your hands because.
Well, I mean, this particular case, it wasn't like that. This baby came in sick, died of ECMO. We can never figure out why. There was no question of abuse. It wasn't an ME case kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was more because they wanted, you know, when you be able, they wanted an answer so we can help them.
Never.
They can have more children or not.
So you don't have to sit shiva for a stillborn.
Right.
So does that mean that the stillborn is not considered a person?
So that's, I believe they are considered a person. They're just a nafel. A nafel, meaning they're a not living person. So. They're still matame, you know, they still need to be buried. Okay, so there's one last wrinkle here, which I think is worthwhile to point out, although we only have a few minutes, so I don't want to take too long. And this really requires a much longer discussion. It's the nuclear word in this context, but I think it is important to think about, and that is the word rodef, the law of the pursuer. Because here you have, you know, Typhoid Mary. Wait a second. Typhoid Mary is running around infecting people. And the Mishnah says, if you look on the last page, I just gave a couple of marmakomos on Rodev. These are people that if you see them chasing others, you're allowed to kill them. So now, do we say that this patient who's got this disease, patient zero, are they a rodev? What would you say? Are they chasing down other people?
If they know what they have.
Okay, great. So here's the first question: are they rodev bekavana or shalom bekavana? Intentional or not intentional? And then the further complication is, well, does it matter? Does it matter whether it's intentional? So if on source number two, in this Sefer Imre Moshe, he has a great chakira, which is the person who is the rodef, is he now going to be killed by you, the bystander, because he's chai of misa, and you're just implementing the din misa that's standing over him? Or no, it's because you need to save the potential would-be victim, irrespective of whether the guy is chayav misa or not. Well, that might be an afkamina. Nobody's chayav misa if they kill someone unintentionally, unwittingly. So if it's the first side, then you're going to say, you can't take him out, you can't treat him like a rodef, because he's not chayav misa, it was bishogeg, or misasik potentially even. But if it's for the purpose of saving the near duff, the person who's being pursued, the people around them, so then you'd say, yeah, you can put them to death, even if it's shalom b'kavana. What about a rodef ayide grama? this person who has this illness, is he actually biyadayim murdering the people who he comes in contact? No. It's almost like a grama. It's indirect. So on the one hand, you would say he's not chayav misa, so you can't treat him as a rodef. On the other hand, he is infecting people and potentially killing them, ayde grama, so you want to save the victim. So in the bottom here, the Bir HaGra says, if you're misaking the rabbim, afal pishein kavanasa l'saking. Even if you're not intending. However, Rav Shechter, when I spoke to him, he quoted many achronim who disagree, who say that if it's shelo b'kavana, then you don't invoke the din of rodef. So that would be the...
But how do you define kavana? For instance, is it the person who says, I know I'm going to kill people, I don't care, I want to give it, or no, I don't believe that I'm not really killing people, I'm washing my hands, and so, and that's it.
Great, so that would be an important distinction. In the second case, that might be negligence, or gross negligence, maybe you would even call it on the verge of insanity. But I remember there was a case, they have these medical cases. I remember when I was in, I think it was Rabbi Teller's class, there was a woman by the name of Mary Northern, who in the 70s, she was admitted to a hospital in Tennessee, and the doctor said she had gangrene in her legs, they needed to amputate them, and she said, no, I don't.
We discussed this case.
Yes, we did mention this case once. So there, the court ruled that she was incompetent. She was, you can't say you don't, what do you know about gangrene? The doctor said you have it. So there too, the guy says, oh, I'm not going to get anybody else sick. So, that's more like a pshia than it is a mazit. That's not willful intent to kill people, but it's certainly negligence. So this is a complicated shaila nachronim. But Rav Shechter had an amazing chap. Because the nafkamina of this would be, I guess the most extreme would be killing patient zero to save other people. That's obviously the most extreme case of rodef. But quarantine would be the simplest answer. Can you forcibly quarantine this patient zero and say, look, you can't leave your house, you're done, you're stuck, you're staying here. And we'll force you to do that. But if you say that you don't paskin that the rodef, you see, there's also a story here in this Minchas Chinuch about Suffolk rodef. So Shechter had a different idea. He says, and this comes back to something you mentioned earlier. The halacha is that in an ideal Torah society, kofin ala mitzvos, the Beis Din, the rabbinical court, has the right, the authority, and even the responsibility to coerce people to fulfill mitzvos. You don't want to put on tefillin, the Beis Din will take you out the back and encourage you in our special Chicago way that you really do want to put on tefillin. You don't want to shake the lulav, we're going to encourage you. You really do want to shake the lulav. Okay, that's the halacha. So Shechter pointed out that that's also true for lo sase. You want to violate shaving with a razor, God forbid, the Beis Din will encourage you, they will force you not to do that. So Shechter said, imagine you have somebody walking down the street who every person they see punches them. So that person is a violation of the Isur D'oraisa of Chovil B'chaveiro, of wounding people. So what would the Beis Din do? They would take that person and they would incarcerate them or coerce them to stop hurting people. So he said, on those grounds, you can quarantine the patient zero. Because it's like kofen ala mitzvos. That person, by walking around, is a walking lo Yosef ben Yosef and walking endangerment to the public. And so the same way that the Beis Din would stop somebody, obviously, who walked around smashing the car windows one by one on the block, the Beis Din would say, that's more complicated with the Isra Masik, but the idea would be to say, you can't just go around punching people in the nose. Memela, you'd say the same thing for the person who is the patient who has the potential to damage other people.
And we have the same problem constantly in the ICU where kids are coming in with communicable infections or suspected until we can prove otherwise. They have symptoms, so they're in isolation. Parents, visitors have to wear gowns, hats, and masks.
Right.
When they go out, they don't spread it when they use the communal areas like the eating area and things like that. And you have parents constantly who refuse to do it.
And it's the same thing. I always wanted to do something and just encourage them highly. And the hospital's always loaded.
Of course.
To get involved, and we have
then they get into conflicts, exactly.
Well, but the hospital I work at, you know, is trying to require everybody to get a flu shot. But there are some people who refuse.
Right.
But they make them wear masks. Doesn't like you
that
mean,
I don't know. But in order for them to get to be allowed not to get it, they have to come to us, to the chaplains. We have to examine them to see that they have a religious basis for this, because apparently in many cases it's a religious basis.
When I was in residency in medical school in New York, that's when they started mandating, because after the big H1N1. And the nurses, of all people, who took the lawsuit saying we shouldn't be forced to get a flu shot, which is sad, because they should. These are one people, them doctors, you know, we're the ones who should know the best and be teaching people, and they were the ones who challenged it in the courts. And the courts said we can't force them to get a flu shot, but the hospitals can't put it on a positive. So in every hospital I've been, if you don't have the flu shot on file, you have to wear a mask. Mm. And in some hospitals, they even give you a scarlet letter. You have to wear there's a sticker that goes on your ID tag when you get the flu shot. And if you don't have it, you don't get the sticker. That's how they can, when they walk around, they know to make sure you're wearing the mask you're supposed to. Then you have to explain to every patient when you come in the room why you're the only nurse wearing the mask.
So this is the lumdus that Rav Schechter uses to explain why it is that you are permitted to quarantine such a person because he's posing a risk to others. So to come back to the New York Times article, so is there a benefit to finding this person? So you have to ask the physicians, and if there is, you know, identifying him what the benefit is, and you have to think about the immediate consequences for other people, and then the research consequences, and both of those are going to dictate how far you're going to go in terms of actual intervention to deal with this
patient. So they identify the guy, which is one thing, but then they